Okay, first of all, can you get everyone to come up a bit closer? You can bring your chairs a bit closer, it makes it much easier. And we're going to do a sutta from the Digha Nikaya today. We've got copies of it on the table over there. So if you haven't got a copy of that sutta yet, please take it. Did you want one? Okay. So those who just come in, we're going to be doing the ninth sutta in the Digha Nikaya today, the Potapada Sutta. And I've spent this morning photocopying copies, so if you want a copy of that sutta, it's on the table for you. The Potapada Sutta. And the reason I decided on this one today is because we've gone through the Majjhima Nikaya so many times. And there are some really nice suttas in the other collections, and this is one of them, one of my favorites. And it's not that long. However, it's just really got some amazing stuff in it. And because of its depth and profundity, and because this is the last one before the rains retreat, I thought, let's go for broke and do the Potapada Sutta today. Are you ready? Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So this is the ninth sutta in the first collection called the Digha Nikaya, called Potapada Sutta, which is a huge sutta about non-self, about the different types of bodies, about consciousness, about jhanas. The whole works are in this sutta. It's a great one. Thus have I heard. Once the Lord was staying at Sarvati in Jeta's Grove in Anathapindika's park. And at that time the wanderer Potapada was at the debating hall near the Tinduka tree in the single-halled park of Queen Malika with a large crowd of about 300 wanderers. Queen Malika, one of the queens of King Pasenadi, was a devoted Buddhist, but even in those days, devout Buddhists would also look after other religions at the same time. So she had a little park, she put a hall there, and people from other religions, anybody basically, could come there, stay in the grounds, and they'd have these debates in the hall. The debating tradition where philosophers, religious people would come up and answer questions and debate on certain topics was common in the time of the Buddha in India. Then the Lord, rising early, took his robe and bowl and went to Sarvati for alms. But it occurred to him, it is too early to go to Sarvati for alms. Suppose I were to go to the debating hall to see the wanderer Potapada. And he did so. That's just classic text. The same thing occurs in many other suttas. We don't need to believe that was actually true. It's just the ordinary introduction. There Potapada was sitting with his crowd of wanderers, all shouting and making a great commotion, indulging in various kinds of unedifying conversation, such as about kings, robbers, ministers, armies, dangers, wars, food, drink, clothes, beds, gardens, perfumes, relatives, carriages, villages, towns and cities, countries, women, heroes, street, and well gossip. Talk of the departed, desultory chat, speculations about land and sea, talk of being and non-being. And that's again standard description of just that useless babble. But Potapada saw the Lord coming from a distance, and so he called his followers to order, saying, "Be quiet, gentlemen, don't make a noise, gentlemen. That ascetic Gotama is coming, and he likes quiet and speaks in praise of quiet. If he sees this company is quiet, he will most likely want to come and visit us." And at this, the wanderers fell silent. First of all, the Potapada, like many of the other non-Buddhists, would call him the ascetic Gotama, not the Buddha, not the Blessed One. Ascetic is samana, the samana Gotama. And from the word samana, we get the shaman word shamans today. It's the original Indian word meaning just an ascetic, like a holy man. And obviously that by this time the Buddha was at least respected by the other groups to the point that Potapada actually wanted the Buddha actually to come. Then the Lord came to Potapada, who said, "Come, Reverend Lord, welcome, Reverend Lord. At last the Reverend Lord has come out of his way to come here. Be seated, Lord, a seat is prepared." And the Lord sat down on the prepared seat, and Potipharah took a low stool and sat to one side, which is usually what people do. It's interesting in the Asian traditions, you never sit in front of a teacher. You always sit to the side, and there's a little alleyway in between there. And it's actually, being a monk, sometimes that's very important, because sometimes you get someone plonks themselves right in front of you when you're giving a talk, and it really means to say, look at me, look at me, look at me. That's what they want to do. So it's always sit to the one side. And it's always the way of respect that when someone's teaching, you take a low seat, they take a high seat. And the Lord sat down on the prepared seat, and Potipharah took a low stool and sat down at one side. The Lord said, Potipharah, what were you all talking about? What conversation have I interrupted? And Potipharah replied, Lord, never mind the conversation we were having just now. It would not be difficult for the Lord to hear about that later. So push aside what's happening. Now we get to the start of the sutta. In the past few days, Lord, the discussion among the ascetics and Brahmins of various schools, sitting together and meeting in the debating hall, has concerned the higher extinction of consciousness and how this takes place. So this is, they used in the debating hall for what its purpose was. People would come over there, different sects, different schools, different religions, and they'd sit in there and they'd spend all day discussing these abstruse things. The higher extinction of consciousness, that's the Abhisanya Nirodha. Nirodha is a cessation, complete disappearing. And here, in this whole sutta here, you need to point out that the word which they use here for consciousness, which sometimes he just says perception, is a usual word which in Buddhism we call perception, sanya. But as the translator Maurice Walsh, as every commentator knows, the way that word is used, like, you know, perceptions, it's used so closely with the word consciousness. That, you know, in other words, this is just what consciousness does, it perceives. And so because of that, the idea of consciousness and perception are just so intertwined that Maurice Walsh quite reasonably sometimes uses consciousness, sometimes uses the word perception. So whenever you hear consciousness or perception in this sutta, it's the same word, sanya. And I mention that because this is important to understand what the original words are here. So say the higher extinction of consciousness, not a temporary sensation, but stopping of consciousness. And the abhi. Abhi means anything which is, I want to say here, the higher, the really deep extinction of consciousness, not something superficial. You might call having a sedative or being anaesthetized before an operation. That we call like an ordinary extinction of consciousness. This is like an abhi, sanya, nirodha, the deep extinction of consciousness. In the same way, just on the side, the original meaning of abhidharma was not a set of books, but it was like the deeper dhamma, which you get from like a practicing monk or nun. So they were debating on the high extinction of consciousness and how it takes place. Some said, one's perception, stroke consciousness, arise and cease without cause or condition. When they arise, one is conscious. When they cease, then one is unconscious. Now, I don't want to make any difference here between perceptions, because you might as well have translated that, when perceptions arise, one is percipient. When perceptions cease, one is unpercipient. Or when consciousness arises, one is conscious. When consciousness ceases, then one is unconscious. It's the same word here. So I don't want to get confused between like perception and consciousness here are two different words, exactly the same word. That is how they explained it. But someone else said, no, that's not how it is. Perception, stroke, consciousness are a person's self, which comes and goes. When it comes, one is conscious. When it goes, one is unconscious. Another said, that is not how it is. There are ascetics and Brahmins of great powers, of great influence. They draw down consciousness into a man and withdraw it. When they draw it down to him, he is conscious. When they withdraw it, he is conscious. Another said, no, that's not how it is. There are deities of great powers, of great influence. They draw down consciousness into a man and withdraw it. When they draw it down into him, he is conscious, and when they withdraw it, he is unconscious. It was in this connection that I thought of the Lord. Ah, surely the blessed Lord, the welfarer, he is supremely skilled about these matters. The blessed Lord, the Buddha, well understands a higher extinction of consciousness. What then, Lord, is this higher extinction of consciousness? Okay, so that's what it says here. Let's actually summarize what it really means. The four possibilities here is like, just let's take away the perceptions, just call it what it really means, consciousness. Some say just consciousness arises and ceases without cause and conditions. It does not just mean here and now. It means where your consciousness came from in this very life. You just, consciousness comes into this life when you're born. It's just without any cause or condition. It's just fortuitous. Consciousness arises. And when you die, just consciousness stops. That's all it is. No cause, no condition. That's really what they're meaning in the first one. The second one is, no, that's not it how it is. Perceptions or consciousness are a person's self which comes and goes. When it comes, like a soul comes into your life, then consciousness comes with it. And when the soul goes, consciousness goes. One is unconscious. Or the body is unconscious. So consciousness being a person's self and comes and goes. Understand that? There's a common idea. Third one. No, that's not it. The ascetics and Brahmins are great powers, a great influence. They draw down consciousness into a person. They animate a person. And they can take it away again. It's just like some magician who animates like a doll or a corpse and makes it alive. And the fourth one is the common theistic one. Another said, no, that's not how it is. There are deities of great power, of great influence. Not just one, but many, their suggestion. And they can draw down consciousness into a person and withdraw it. When they draw it down into them, they are conscious. When they withdraw it, they are unconscious. That's how it is. They're asking, where does this consciousness come from into this life, and where does it go to afterwards? That was the question. And especially, how does the consciousness end? Now, are you clear about what they were debating? Great Brahmins, which just means people with psychic powers, the original Brahmins who would be in the forests meditating, who've got enormous psychic powers, who can do such things, and create beings. So the idea was. Yes. For example, do you remember that the Sorcerer's Apprentice, done by Walt Disney, I think, when Mickey Mouse had to sweep the sorcerer's room? And you must have seen that little cartoon years and years ago. It was very famous. And he was sweeping the room, but he got too lazy. So he got a spell out of his master's book. So the broom swept itself. And the broom was sweeping, but the broom went crazy. He couldn't stop it sweeping. And so he cut it in two. And then he cut it in, but then he had two brooms sweeping crazily. And it's almost like they were animating the broom and giving it life, like a spell to bring something which was unconscious into consciousness. That's really what it means. It's like a magic spell to turn this bell into a conscious living entity. That's what it's pointing to. Okay? Yeah. And by chance, consciousness stops. Soul equals consciousness. When the soul comes, we're conscious. Could actually put a soul into you, as it were. Yeah. And of course, you can relate to those questions now. Now, the Buddha answers. In this matter, Potapada, those ascetics and Brahmins who say one's consciousness arises and ceases without cause and conditions are totally wrong. Why is it? One's consciousness arises and ceases according to causes and conditions. Some perceptions arise through training and some pass away through training. What is this training? The Lord said. Now this is actually where the Buddha really starts. He doesn't actually answer the other questions. He just starts on this one, and the whole sutta actually follows from this. Sometimes that happens. You haven't got a chance to answer everybody's questions after a Dharma talk. Their first question just goes off into a whole sutta by itself. So what is this consciousness or perceptions arising and ceasing through a training? And here the Buddha starts with what is known as a gradual path. A Tathagata arises in the world, an Arahat, fully enlightened Buddha, endowed with wisdom and conduct, welfare and knower of the world, incomparable trainer of people to be tamed, teacher of gods and humans, enlightened and blessed. He, having realized by his own super knowledge, proclaims this world, you know, the visible world here, with its devas, maras, this world, in other words, the whole universe, the cosmos, with its different types of beings, devas, maras, and brahmas, its princes and people. He preaches a dharma which is lovely in the beginning, in the middle, in the end, in the spirit and in the letter, and displays a fully perfected and purified life, holy life. The abbreviation there is because this passage occurs in the first 13 suttas in this collection here. But in brief, it is about a person gains faith in the Buddha, and they think that dusty is the household life, free of dust, like the open air, is the homeless life. Why don't I shave off my hair and beard and wear the yellow cloth and go forth from home into homelessness? And abandoning either a large or small fortune, a large or small circle of relations, he goes forth. And going forth, they stop various unprofitable practices, you know, such as accepting money, buying and selling, having slaves and stuff like that. And these are like the moralities, and they start to keep things like five precepts, the simple people. And then that Pada, that monk who's perfected in morality, sees no danger from any side. And then he starts to guard the sense doors here, so that anything which he sees, which he hears, smells, tastes, touch, or even knows, to make sure that they don't grasp at it to create a fever of lust or ill will. You know, you're guarding those sense bases to keep them reasonably still and peaceful. And having guarded the five sense doors, then you put an effort to abandon the five hindrances. The five hindrances of the desire for the five sensory world, the ill will, the sloth and torpor, restlessness and remorse, and the doubt. And having subdued those five hindrances, then you attain the first jhana. And this is where we get to in your piece of paper there. Standard, if you want to look at more of that, you'll find that in many, many places, even in your book in the Majjhima Nikaya, I think Sutta 62, I think it's got a whole lot, even 36, I think it's got it in there, the gradual training. Looking in the back, you see the whole thing. But here it says, having reached the first jhana, they remain in it. Now, here he's got a very bad translation. Whatever sensations of lust, this is again, whatever perceptions of the five senses that he previously had, this is karma sanya. Whatever perceptions of the sensations, here was a really big typo, it should have been perceptions. He has lust here, I prefer the five senses. Whatever perceptions of the five senses that he previously had disappear. And that time there is present a true but subtle perception of delight and happiness, born of detachment, and it becomes one who is conscious of this delight and happiness, or is percipient. Perception and consciousness here interchangeable. In this way, some perceptions arise through training, and some pass away through training. And this is that training, said the Lord. Remember the question he was asking? Do perceptions arise and cease without cause and condition? These are different types of consciousness. So an old consciousness has ended and a new consciousness has arisen. Now this is actually the important point here, which is I wanted to stress here. Here it gives a unique, not found anywhere else, description of the first jhana. First of all, it's this place where the Pali is so clear. At that time, there is present a first of all, the consciousness of the five senses. Well, you here have sensations of lust. The karma sanya that he previously had disappears. This is what he's saying about some consciousness, some perceptions disappear. And anyone who's experienced that first jhana would know that it is a different type of consciousness, different species of consciousness. In the same way there's a human being and there's the birds or there's the worms. Yeah, there's something which they have in common, but they're different species, completely different. So this is the different species. One type of consciousness has disappeared, and another one is there. And what is there afterwards? A true but subtle perception of delight and happiness. That is the piti sukha. And this is a wonderful place where it says it's very subtle, very strong, but very subtle. In other words, it's different than many other consciousnesses. It's very type. It's so extraordinary. And the most important thing here, they have it make it very clear, born of viveka, born of detachment. And what is it detached from? It says elsewhere in there that it's detached from this five-sense world. When those five senses, the five-sense consciousness disappears, this true but subtle perception of piti-sukha, of delight and happiness, is born. It comes because the other thing has disappeared. In this way, some perceptions or some consciousnesses arise through training and some pass away through training. And this is that training. And this is the start of what's coming next. But is that quite clear so far? You've got the ordinary consciousness of the world, the five sense consciousness. That has disappeared. And the consciousness of the first jhana is now there. True but subtle. And it's a happiness born of detachment. Okay, paragraph 11. Again, a meditator with the subsiding of thinking and pondering. Maurice Walsh, I used to know him as a very sweet man. I liked him very much. But sometimes he didn't have too much deep meditation. There's no thinking and pondering. So thinking and pondering subsided a long time ago. This is the movement of the mind onto the object, which holds onto the object. That stops. That's what I call the wobble of the first jhana. Now that's disappeared. Getting inner tranquility. The word is not tranquility, it's inner confidence. The inner confidence is the ability to let go completely. And the unity of the mind. Chetazo ekodi bawa. It's come to oneness, to a singleness. And if you contemplate on what that means, a singleness of mind means what many people in Mahayana understand as a non-dual mind. Absolutely non-dual. There's no two at all possible there. An absolute unity of consciousness. And this is the first time, according to the Buddha, that such unity occurs. So by gaining the inner confidence and the unity of mind, or the non-dual mind, if you like, they reach and remain the second jhana, which is free from this movement of the mind, born of samadhi, filled with delight and happiness. The reason why it's called born of samadhi is because it's that absolute stillness of the mind gives it the piti sukha, gives it the delight. There's before, in the first jhana, there's still a movement there. Only a wobble, but still a movement. This is the first time when the mind is absolutely rock solid. My word, absolutely. And that's the meaning of samadhi. Here, that word samadhi reaches its peak in the second jhana. So this is no more movement. Coming now. So his former true but subtle consciousness of delight and happiness born of detachment vanishes. That consciousness is gone. At that time there arises a true but subtle perception or true but subtle consciousness of delight and happiness born of concentration, born of samadhi. And he becomes one who is conscious of this delight and happiness. In this way, some perceptions arise through training. Some pass away through training. So what you just asked, the Buddha just was answering. The consciousness of the first jhana is gone, and the second jhana is another completely different species. That's why I've sometimes said in the talk, if you get in any of these jhanas, if you ever get a first jhana, you think, my goodness, that's a peak. There can't be anything more than this. But then when that sort of develops into the second jhana, it's completely different. Another different species altogether. That's why, you know, sometimes you wonder just where this lot all ends. And this is the whole purpose of this sutta, to show you where it does end. That's what I've always been saying, yes. But it's so different that the Buddha here is actually saying it's like a different species. It's not just, again, sometimes that when we start translating these things as perception, where here the word sanya is used as more like consciousness. And it's just the consciousness is just, one is completely disappearing. a very good simile, which I'll come up later, because he said, is there just one peak of cessation or many peaks of cessation? And it's just like the mountain range with many, many peaks. And the next one is not further along the track, but you have to almost like disappear from the first one and go up again. It is in one way of looking at it, yes. Another way of looking at it is completely different. The best way of description which I've given is like the petals of a lotus. You know the lotus simile which I've given many times? 1,000-petal lotus. As the petals open out, you see what's inside. The petals which were closed a few seconds ago. And as those open out, there's another layer of petals inside. Otherwise, the simile of the Russian dolls. You take out, you know, this little Russian doll painted in wood, you take it apart, there's another one inside, but slightly smaller. So there's something similar there, but they're completely different dolls. One inside the other. Sure, something's dropped away. There's also something completely different. And again, after the fading away of delight, I felt this delight is this pity. They dwell in equanimity, mindful and clearly aware, and they experience in the body of that achievement that pleasant feeling which the noble ones say, happy dwells the person of equanimity and mindfulness. And they reach and remain in the third jhana. Their former true but subtle sense or subtle perception of delight and happiness born of concentration vanishes, and arises at that time a true but subtle perception of equanimity and happiness. And they become one who is conscious of this true but subtle perception of equanimity and happiness. In this way that some perceptions, some consciousness arise through training, and some pass away through training. And again, with the abandonment of pleasure and pain, with the that's physical happiness which went a long time ago, or the disappearance of the previous joy and grief, which is the mental happiness and pain, and this was specifically mentioning here the mental happiness, they reach and remain in the fourth jhana, a state beyond pleasure and pain, beyond dukkha and sukha, either of body or mind, purified by equanimity and mindfulness. Their former true but subtle sense or perception or consciousness of equanimity and happiness vanishes, and it arises a true but subtle perception or consciousness of neither happiness nor unhappiness, of equanimity. And they become one who is conscious of this true but subtle perception of neither happiness nor unhappiness. In this way, some consciousnesses or perceptions arise through training, and some pass away through training. And again, by passing entirely beyond bodily sensations, by the disappearance of all sense of resistance, and this is when there's complete freedom of the mind, and by non-attraction to the perceptions of diversity, seeing that space is infinite, or I like to say like unbounded, unlimited, they reach and remain in the sphere of infinite space. And that's actually is a perception. In this way that some perceptions arise through training, another one passed away through training. The old perception of the fourth jhana is gone, a new perception or a new consciousness arises. And again by passing entirely beyond the sphere of infinite space, seeing that consciousness, that which knows the infinite space, is unlimited, unbound, you reach and remain in the sphere of infinite consciousness. In this way, the perception of infinite space has disappeared. Another perception of infinite consciousness has arisen through training. And this is why some arise and some pass away. If you want to know exactly what these immaterial states actually mean, I gave a decent description of them in a little book on jhanas. What it really means is the way to get your handle on this, to understand it, is to go through a metaphor for your own experience in meditation when you start going into the present moment awareness, which just about all of you have achieved as a beginning stage of meditation. You might say like the infinity of time, because when you go into that present moment, you've got all the time in the world. You know, time is just spacious for you. At the same time, there's no time at all. Because you know, there's no moment, it's just this moment. There's no minutes, there's no hours, there's no years. Which is why when you get into a nice state of meditation, you just don't know how many minutes have gone past. It's timeless, no time, but also infinity of time. This is an experience which You know, even in mathematics, you know, the infinite and zero are just, you know, two sides of the same line. There's something which they have in common. And this is really what we're meaning here. The infinity of space is almost means no space. Space disappearing. And this is what the infinity of consciousness is. Consciousness disappearing. Okay, so what happens when this consciousness has disappeared and space has disappeared? What's left? Nothing. And that's a third immaterial. Again, by passing entirely beyond the sphere of infinite consciousness, seeing that there is no thing, they reach and remain in the sphere of no-thingness. And they become one who is conscious of this true but subtle perception of nothingness. You are conscious of nothing. In this way, some perceptions arise through training and some pass away through training. And that is this training. They don't go any further than this, even though you probably know the next stage is neither perception nor non-perception. The reason you don't go further than that, you can't say it's conscious or not conscious. Here you're conscious of nothing, and then the consciousness disappears. But then you know there's no consciousness. So are you conscious or are you not conscious? If you look for the one who's knowing, yes you are. If you look for what you're knowing, no you're not. So that's why we get this wonderful little saying here. It's only just a tiny step there for the full cessation of consciousness to happen where there's nothing left. But that's as far as the Buddha goes here. Now again, most was to bless him, because I still like the fellow. He does make another typical mistake of people who don't know how to meditate. Part of from the moment when the monk has gained this controlled perception. The Pali word is like sakasanya. It just means like reflective perception. You know, your own perception, perceiving what's going on inside. When it's called your own perception, he thought whatever is yours, you control. It's, you know, you have proprietary rights over. That's why he made that terrible little translation there. But what it really means, it means like reflective perception. And seeing what's going on inside. So, for the moment when the monk has gained this inner perception, reflective perception, looking inside rather than looking out here, you proceed from stage to stage until you reach the limit of perception, or the limit of consciousness. When he has reached the limit of perception, it occurs to him, or this limit of perception, and this is a very good translation, mental activity is worse for me. Mental activity is worse for me, as it says there. Lack of mental activity is better. And by activity, it means activating a mind. It's not like a mind being still and just being there. Because when it stops doing things, it disappears. Whereas if you activate something, it comes into existence. And here, you're deactivating it. So your computer is crashing. So he is actually realizing, it occurs to him, this is a great insight, mental activity is worse for me, lack of mental activity is better. If I were to think and imagine, that is if I was to will, is the first word, will and plan, these perceptions that I have, in other words, my mind started to move, these perceptions I have attained would cease and coarser perceptions would arise in me. Suppose I were not to will and plan. So he neither wills nor plans. And then in him just these perceptions arise and other coarser perceptions do not arise. A beautiful saying about how these things actually happen. No willing, no planning. And this is just what happens. This is what letting go is. You don't do meditation. You don't will your meditation. You don't think it. You don't imagine it. You don't plan it. You just get out of the way, and these things cease. One perception ceases, another one comes in its place. For those of you who've been stuck on the breath, you've got to allow the perception of the breath to disappear for another perception to arise, more subtle but true. For many people, when the breath disappears, oh, they've been saying recently they see a blank screen. Great! One perception has disappeared, another one has come up, a more subtle one, a blank screen. Fine, stay there. After a while, the perception of a blank screen will disappear, and then you see the perception of a nimitta. One perception disappears, another one arises. How does that happen? Because you don't plan, you don't will, you don't think, you don't imagine, you don't do anything. We'll say, mental activity is worse for me. Surely you should have known that by now. Lack of mental activity is better. So, and eventually you attain cessation. And that potapada is the way in which the cessation of perception is brought about by successive steps. So it's not just... Okay, there is a slight difference. Because really, if I'm going to be dogmatic, the cessation of perception really is the fourth immaterial, the state of neither perception nor non-perception. That's right, yeah. But the real cessation happens just after that, when everything disappears. And that's what he's talking about. This is the higher, extreme cessation of consciousness. There has to be, yes. I think the Visuddhimagga's got a point there. I think you just probably have to be at least a stream winner before you've got the guts and the courage to let go so much. No. But, you know, because that's the point there. If you come out, you certainly are an anagami. Or an arahat, one of the two. Yeah. That's right, yes. It doesn't actually say that you have to be a stream winner to attain those states of cessation. So it doesn't say that anywhere that I've heard of, not in the suttas anyway, but it makes a little bit of sense. Why can't people let go? And why can't they get into the jhanas sometimes? And there's a couple of reasons. One is because, you know, the purity of their heart, their conduct isn't, the mind isn't strong enough and pure enough. It's not letting go enough. And the other cause, which they're both connected, is because of a strong sense of wanting to be, a sense of self. Stream entry actually will just weaken that sense of self so much and give you the opportunity to disappear. When you know there's nobody here, you can let it go. As long as you think there's someone here that, you know, this really is something, it's very hard to let it go. If you realize that, you know, your car, your house, your jewels and your money wasn't yours, you know, you could let it go very easily. But if you think it's yours, then it's very hard to let it go. It's not impossible, though. Now, this is an interesting statement. Paragraph 18. What do you think, Potapada? Have you heard of this before? No, Lord. As I understand it, the Lord has said, Potapada, from the moment when a monk has gained this inner perception, self-perception, they proceed from stage to stage until he reaches the limits of perception, they attain perception, and this is the way in which the cessation of perception is brought about by successive steps. That is right, Potapada. I'm having a great argument with some monks, not of our temple, but other because I wrote in my little book that the Buddha discovered the jhanas. And I love putting those things out there because there was one scholar wrote that some time ago, but I wrote that out. There's a lot of ground for that. It's actually mentioned by a couple of devas in the Sanyutta Nikaya. It's repeated by Ananda in another sutta. And there's lots of other evidences in the Citta Sanyutta where the Buddha starts... No, not the Buddha. One of the Buddha's disciples starts to talk to Mahavira, the leader of the Jains, that's about second jhana. He can actually stop all thinking. And the Jains said, that's impossible. That's stupid. You can't do that. Which is like second jhana. And obviously the leader of the Jains had no idea that such a thing existed. So that there's a lot of evidence that the Buddha actually did rediscover the jhanas. So not discover them first of all because they would have been from previous Buddhas, but completely lost to the world and rediscovered them and taught them. And here, this is also why Potapada, even though he was a wanderer and went to all these discussions, I never heard that before. Alava Kalamudaka Ramaputta. First of all, they taught two immaterial states. And those states, they could not have been the real thing. Because the Buddha even says in other suttas that those things are beautiful, they're good, you can use those things to attain the full insights. And secondly, that it's well known in all these suttas here, you have to do this successively. You have to go into the jhanas, first of all, before you go to these immaterial states. You can't suddenly go from nothing to the immaterial attainments. So you have to do the jhanas. But it's quite clear the Buddha never did the jhanas, the four jhanas, with the Lava Kalama, Uddhakarama Putta. And the reason for that is first of all that, you know, he remembered the only other time he'd done a jhana was under the rose apple tree. He completely sort of bypassed his experiences under Alava Kalama and Uddhakarama Putta to remember the jhana as a kid, which, you know, shows he didn't have the first jhana or any other jhanas under those two teachers. But number two, as you all remember, that when he remembered that experience, he realized you have to have a reasonably fit and healthy body to be able to attain those things. You can't get those attainments when you're sort of too ascetic. And for all his life, even under Uddhakarama Putta, the Lava Kalama, he was just too ascetic. And when he started the middle path of eating properly, sleeping properly, bathing, his father, the ascetics, who had been through him, with him all the time, said, no, that's your being slack. You're just not really practicing properly, you're just being too indulgent. And you know, they had to do this to get the jhanas. And if he'd been doing the jhanas under Uddhakarama Putta, Lava Kalama, his five friends would have left him then. There's a lot of evidence. And the answer is, and I've convinced a few monks in my monastery of this, and I think it's probably the answer. What those two teachers were teaching were not the real thing, but were just like the remembrance. They had the name, but not the experience. In the same way that even today, you know, that some people can teach sort of jhanas, they call it jhanas, but they're certainly not jhanas. They're much lesser attainment. In the same way, like degrees at university, over the years, they get less and less stringent, more easy for more people to attain. And I always remember just anyone who's read Goethe and, what's his name, Dr. Faustus, that begins with Dr. Faustus having been awarded a PhD from his university. The first PhD in about 5 or 6 years or something. In those days, to get a PhD, you know, they only issued one every sort of, you know, 5, 10 years or something. So you had to be really, really, really special. And now they issue hundreds every year. So the standard has gone down. And that's natural, that happens. And I think this is probably what happened. The standard for those attainments went down so much. They weren't the real thing. And that's why when the Buddha practiced them, so they didn't really mean anything. They're very easy, number one. And they didn't really mean much. Yeah. Oh, yeah, sure. Yes. Yes. Only, but that's after he got his jhana, after he developed his psychic powers. Then in the first watch of the night, under the Bodhi tree, is a bodhisattva who remembered his past lives. And it's massive. If you had a past life under the Buddha, of course you'd remember that. That would stand out. That was a special one. And you remember all the teachings you heard there. And also what you practiced as well. Yeah. Mm. Correct, yes, correct. Those names, that's right, yes. Very likely. So you know, there was a seed of something very old. And we do have that, you know, some of the things which, like the bishop's mitre, comes from the Mithraic rites of Rome. That's where it comes from. But they've, you know, for some reason, that. They've taken that up and put it on their heads. But its origin is very clear from a pre-Christian religion. There's many little things like that. Anyway, so now we go, paragraph 19. This is what I say about those many peaks. Lord, do you teach that the summit of perception is just one, or that it is many? I teach it as both one and many. How can it be one, and how is it many? Accordingly as you attain successively to the cessation of each perception, so I teach the summit of the perception. Thus I teach both one and many summits of perception. And as I understand that, it's pretty enigmatic. You need a bit of interpretation there. As I understand that, that each of those jhanas is such a summit, and they actually each call each one like an ekagata, a high agga, a peak of the mind, that each one of those deserves to be called a summit, like the summits of the Himalaya mountains. Each one is just, you call it a summit, but there's one highest summit of all. So you can say, yeah, there is the highest summit, but each one's, one of those are summits as well. And he keeps on asking, Lord, does perception or consciousness arise before knowledge, or knowledge arise before perception, or do both arise simultaneously? The Buddha says, perception arises first, Potapada, then knowledge, and from the arising of perception comes the arising of knowledge. And one knows, thus conditioned, knowledge arises. In this way you can see how the perception arises first and then knowledge, and that from the arising of perception comes the arising of knowledge. Now, of course, that also means the knowledge, the word is knowledge, is like jnana, it's like insights. You get the experience first, and then you get the insights. You don't get the insights first, and then the insights, as it were, condition your perceptions. That is called like the, perverting of the cognitive process. However, that happens with some people. You know, sometimes, you know, to real true knowledge, real jnana, sometimes people have the knowledge first of all, and it just changes your perceptions. Just what I was saying, if you really fall in love with someone, that changes your perceptions. And jnana, the knowledge, the ideas come first of all, and your perceptions actually change. You only see what's really true. But that's not really what the jnana means here. The word knowledge is more like the true insight, true deep knowledge. And that only comes after the experiences. Now, Potapada, who loves asking lots of questions, and the Buddha is very patient, starts to ask, Lord, is perception a person's self? Or is perception one thing and self another? Well, let's change that to the consciousness again. Is consciousness oneself? Or is consciousness one thing and self another? Are you your consciousness? Well, Potapada, do you postulate a self, an atta? An atta literally means an essence. They use the suffix atta to change something into like a ness, or like you have monk and you have monkhood, or you have tired, you have tiredness. And very often you just add that word atta on the end of it. So you can almost think of it as like a nessness, an essence. You got that idea of atta? Some of them call it a self, a soul. The heart, the essence of you, the underlying existence, whatever it is. So, do you postulate such a thing? Lord, I postulate a gross self, material composed of the four elements and feeding on solid food, in other words, a body. But with such a gross self, Potapada, perception will be one thing and the self another. You can see that in this way. Given such a gross self, certain perceptions would arise in that person, others pass away. In that way, you can see that perception must be one thing, the self another. If your consciousness was your body, then when your body passes away, or one consciousness arises, another passes away, your body hasn't passed away. This is understanding that consciousness, which was very clearly seen by the people in that time, and certainly by the Buddha, that consciousness is not a flow, but it's a discrete process. You heard me say before, like the simile of the beach. It looks like it's a solid stretch of sand, not broken at all. But if you look closer, it's made of discrete particles. And between those particles, there's nothing. They're not even touching. In the same way, this flow of consciousness is not continuous. If you look more closely, it's made up of discrete moments of consciousness, particles of sand-like consciousness.
And if you can perceive it properly, you see that when one consciousness disappears, there is a space before the next consciousness arises. So the consciousness. Yeah, but sometimes you can understand that. You can infer it, you can see it. In the same way that the gaps between the sand, you need a microscope to look at that. To see, or at least a magnifying glass, to see that the sand is made up of tiny particles and there's gaps between them. But people have got magnifying glasses these days. These days, you've got jhana. You see it in jhana. It's a magnifying glass, a microscope, to see what consciousness is really up to. So, Potapada, having lost out this body, can't be himself. Say, apasublate, a mind-made self, complete with all its parts, not defective in any sense organ, a manomayakaya. And it's interesting here, the physical body, the mind-made self, is something actually which anyone who's astral traveled, that's your mind-made self. That's why they say it's supposed to be like almost like a soul which leaves your body at death. And actually that mind-made self, that manomayakaya, that's actually what leaves the body in astral traveling. That's what leaves the body and out-of-the-body experiences, which floats up above your body when you think you're dying, or when the consciousness, when the five senses stop and the brain stops for a while. Then that's a manomayakaya. And they say, just over here, complete with all its parts, not defective in any sense organ. Another sutta, the Buddha gives a simile, just like a reed, one of those big reeds of grass. You can take it from out its outer sheath and it looks exactly the same. And this is what he gave, like the mind-made self. You take it out of this body, out of a sheath, and it looks exactly the same. So Lawrence, if your mind-made body would emerge from this at the moment, it would still be having that sort of that black, still fat, yeah, still with the same hairstyle, still laughing. If you've got a few black teeth, that would have black teeth as well. Which is why, like the ghosts, which people see after death, that's a manomayakaya. And it wears the clothes, which it sort of has emerged from its body. So that's why sometimes you see it. You've got all the ears. If you have pierced ears or earrings, that's what you see. And as you were at the time of your death, that's as you were in your mind, everybody. No, not really, no, because that's actually just an ability, not a physical thing. But if you had, we're missing one leg, so your manomayakaya would probably miss one leg as well. And it's a mirror image of what you were when you died, when you left. You were wearing the same clothes. Fascinating. You just, because you're attached to those clothes, your mind-made body just creates those clothes for you. That's why it's always a good idea to make sure you always wear a clean pair of underpants, because that's only a joke. But the Buddha says again, that mind-made body, still consciousness arises and goes away in that body. It can't be. And then lastly he said, I assume a formless self made up of perception. But such a formless self, perceptions would be one thing, the self another, because perceptions come and go. So paragraph 24. And so poor Potapada is completely confused by all of this and says, but Lord, is it possible for me to know whether perception is a person's self or whether perception is one thing or self another? And the Buddha, out of compassion, says, Potapada, it is difficult for you, of different views, of different faith, and different influences, with different pursuits and different training, to know whether these two are different things or not. And the point is, the reason why you can't say they're different, because there is no self. That's his big mistake. Are they the same or are they different? Well, one of those things doesn't exist. It's a waste of time. So, Potapada asks the other questions. Well, Lord, if this question of self and perception is difficult for one like me, tell me this. Is the world eternal, only this true and the opposite force?
And the Buddha said, Potapada, I have not declared that the world is eternal and that the opposite view is false. Well, Lord, is the world not eternal? Look, I have not declared that the world is not eternal. Well, Lord, is the world infinite or not infinite? I have not declared that the world is not infinite and that the opposite view is false. Well, Lord, is the soul the same as a body? Is the soul one thing in the body or the other? I have not declared that the soul is one thing in the body or another. Well, Lord, does a Tathagata, like one who's enlightened, does he... I'm going to change the word exist here to make it more clear why this is not argued. Use the word persist. Does the Tathagata persist after death? Is this true and all else false? I have not declared that the Tathagata persists after death. Well, Lord, does the Tathagata not persist after death? Both persist and not persist after death. Neither persist nor not persist after death. I have not declared that the Tathagata neither persists nor not persists after death, and that all else is false.
Now, when I said that, you understand why, you know, what the problem was, why the Buddha didn't say those things. When you say persists, they say, now, this thing which is now, what happens to it after it passes away? And because it isn't now, this thing which you think there's nothing here now, you can't say it persists. It wasn't in the beginning. So it doesn't really make any sense whether it's going to be afterwards, it's not going to be afterwards, because it wasn't here now. It's like your kids may say, Daddy, when you die, are you going to give your money to me, or are you going to give it to the Buddhist Society or WA? Or are you going to give it to the government? Or are you going to give it to Salvation Army? And you can say, no, I haven't declared that. I haven't said that, because I haven't got any money to give anybody. My money doesn't exist. Do you understand the simile? Yeah, I know, but that's not the meaning of the simile. It's just like the four undeclarables. And your daughter asks you, Daddy, what are you going to do, you know, with your Mercedes-Benz when you die? Are you going to give it to me, or are you going to give it to other people? Or are you going to, which one of those four? Neither of those four answer, because I haven't got a Mercedes-Benz. So does the Tathagata persist after death or not persist? There is no Tathagata. So you can't say it persists or doesn't persist, or both persists and not persists. Now, hopefully I got that across. But the Buddha, because he doesn't want to say about himself not persisting yet, will just completely confuse Potapada. So when the Potapada in paragraph 28 says, but Lord, why has the Lord not declared these things? Potapada is not conducive to the purpose, not conducive to Dharma, not the way to embark on the holy life. It does not lead to disenchantment, to dispassion, to cessation, to calm, to higher knowledge, to enlightenment, to nibbana. That is why I have not declared it. But Lord, what has the Lord taught, declared? Potapada, I have declared this is suffering. What do you mean by this? This. What you're experiencing right now. This. Body, mind, this. Experience. This is suffering. I have declared. What's the origin of suffering? That this is a cessation of suffering, and this is a path into cessation of suffering. But Lord, why has the Lord taught that? Because Potapada, it is conducive to the purpose of ending suffering, conducive to Dharma. It's the way to embark on the holy life. It leads to disenchantment, to dispassion, to cessation, to calm, to higher knowledge, to enlightenment, to nibbana. That is why I've declared it. So it is, Lord. So it is, welfarer. And now is the time for the Blessed One to do as he sees fit. He sees fit, which is the polite way of saying, you know, now you must go. Let's get lost. Then the Lord rose from his seat and went away. Then the wanderers, as soon as the Lord had left, reproached, sneered, and jeered at Potapada from all sides, saying, yeah, whatever the ascetic Gotama says, Potapada agrees with him. So it is, Lord, so it is. We don't understand a word of the ascetic Gotama's whole discourse. Is the world eternal or not? Is it finite or infinite? Is the soul the same as the body? Does the Tathagata exist after death or not, or both or neither? Potapada replied, I don't understand either about whether the world is eternal or not,
whether the Tathagata exists after death or not, or both or neither. But the ascetic Gotama teaches a true and real way of practice, which is consonant with the Dharma and grounded in Dharma. And why should not a man like me express approval of such a true and real practice so well taught by the ascetic Gotama? That's the clincher. All those theories and ideas and philosophers. You know, Potapada is being honest, doesn't understand them. But when you start talking about that practice, which was in the beginning, about, you know, going forth, being virtuous, just sense restraint, practicing jhanas, that's the practice, that makes sense. And that's what really caught Potapada. And all those theories, he didn't understand them. The practice, that's what he enjoyed. That's the same with probably many of you. Sometimes some of the things which we read here, they can be so high. Maybe you might not understand them, but there's something in there about the practice. So yeah, that's the true practice, so there must be something in it. Can I pause there? Anyone want to ask any questions? Because at this point there is a hiatus in the sutta. There's a pause where we get another little session which happens a little bit later. Is there any questions anyone has? Oh, yeah. Indeed, there's no such thing as bare knowing for most people, because the bare knowing is not bare at all. It's just completely under the influence of the five hindrances. So you know only what you want to know. This is the problem. That's why the only knowing which is truly bare is the one where the five hindrances have been stripped away. That's the only one which you can trust. And the only time you have that is after jhanas. That's the whole point of the jhanas, to make it a bare knowing. That's not the only point, so that's half the reason for jhanas, is to give the ability to know, not what you want to see, not... Oh, okay, that bare knowing is just a process. So the bare knowing can know the bare knowing. You can know it truly. You just see it, as I was mentioning, like a grain of sand, one next to another, with nothing going across. So you're empty of an abiding essence, something which doesn't persist. Awareness is... but there's different levels of awareness. That's why they're just like, you know, the old adages of the Inuit Indians, don't know how many types of snow they can understand. Like meditators, just how many types of mindfulness there are. Huge numbers. And until you've actually really got into mindfulness and awareness, really seeing all the different types of awareness it could possibly be, and understand with some really dirty awarenesses, you don't realize they're deceiving you. But after a while you just see this... they've got this beautiful simile which the Buddha said in the Sanghita Nikaya. I told this, I think, the other night. Many of the monks know it off by heart. There was a man who was blind, and this merchant came along selling cloth, and he saw this guy was blind. And so when the merchant said, "What are you selling?" "I'm selling this most amazing, expensive, fashionable cloth straight from Benares, the most famous center of cloth in India at the time. So do you want to buy some? It'd be great for a nice sort of shawl for you." And he said, "No, okay, I'll buy one." And so the merchant, instead of giving him a proper piece of Benares cloth, gave him this dirty, oily rag. He was a blind man, he wouldn't know. And so this blind man gave him all this money, and he had this dirty old rag. But he went around saying, "Look at me, I've got this incredibly expensive, fine Benares cloth. It was so white, so pure." And then one day, just a doctor came along and got some magnificent medicine which cured his sight. And when he could see clearly, and he saw what he'd been sold, he said it was a pure
no muslin, white cloth from Benares, and it's just a dirty old rag. He would be upset, he would be angry. In the same way, the Buddha said, that when you start to see the Dhamma, you really get a bit angry with this terrible stuff you've been sold, this happiness. People have been selling you all these cars and these girls and boys and sex and TVs and digital crystal set TVs for $10,000. You've been conned. The only time is actually to get a jhana, and then actually you have the perspective. There's if your senses are clean. You have the strength, the courage to see what you don't want to see. And then all the denial, all the wishful thinking goes. Ah, I've been conned. Says the guy who realizes he's been sold a doozer. Okay. So, now we come to the second part. Yeah, sorry, yeah? Yes. He did. His defilements were cleared away for a short time. And he got the psychic powers. And that was the thing which stopped him. Because of the psychic powers which he attained, then he got pride. As soon as he got that pride, he lost all of his psychic powers and his ability to gain jhanas. And that's what did him in. Spiritual pride. Which is a danger. You've got this opportunity. The window is open to see the truth. But that window closed. And because of this past karma, just so much pride and ego. That's why he wanted to take over the Sangha. I've seen that happen. I don't know if I told you this story before. In the first year I was a monk in Thailand, there was another one of Ajahn Chah's disciples. I didn't see this happen. It happened a couple of months before I arrived. But he got into such deep meditation, he started, got jhanas and psychic powers, this monk. And he developed, you read in the suttas, as a divine ear. He could start to hear people actually in the market, 10 kilometers away, accurately. Could actually record what they were saying. And he got so proud of his attainments that one day he sort of sat in Ajahn Chah's chair and started giving a talk. And because he thought he was fully enlightened, as good if not better than Ajahn Chah. But Ajahn Chah was very, very skillful, still got him out of that. And then when he sort of recovered, he didn't need to disrobe. When he recovered, in the dining hall in front of about 60 monks, he bowed to everyone in turn and asked forgiveness of everyone. And then he was just a quiet monk. Obviously still doing his deep meditation, had great abilities, but it got rid of his pride. You see it happening. But because even the Buddha was of the same family, I don't think Devadatta would listen much to the Buddha anyway. But this monk, disciple of Ajahn Chah, certainly listened to Ajahn Chah and got through that pride. So that's what happened with Devadatta. Sorry? Yeah, the one with Ajahn Chah's disciple. Yeah, it came good in the end. No, only with a few days. You had to be very skillful sometimes when somebody gets these attainments, huge amounts of power. You get psychic powers. If you're not careful, if you're trying so hard to become enlightened, you really think you are enlightened. And it's just almost impossible to tell them they're not. That's why the typical way is you just got to try somehow or other to make them angry. Make them angry to try and piss them off. Because once they get angry, then that's a sign and they know themselves they're not enlightened. Standard. Okay. So can you hear okay, Lynn, all the time? Okay, yeah. So we're getting to the part two of this sutta. It's very deep. We've just gone through these jhanas. First of all, it's all said about this self, but the other part has got this very original and unique description of the jhanas, which you don't find elsewhere, especially where it says a true but subtle perception. Or subtle consciousness of bliss. Now,
Paragraph 32. Two or three days later, Chitta, the son of the elephant trainer, went with his friend Potapada to see the Lord. Chitta prostrated himself before the Lord and sat down at one side because he was a disciple. In fact, at this particular case, Chitta was a very well-known disciple at that time because this is the guy who had actually been a monk before 6 times and had disrobed 6 times. And this is a story of how he ordained for the 7th time. And again, another happy story. At the very end, because of what the Buddha said here, he ordained again, and this time he made it, became an arahant. And that's why you've heard me say sometimes, it's a tradition based on this story, that if somebody wishes to disrobe as a monk, they can disrobe, they can come back again. We usually give them 7 times. There's no rule in there in the Vinaya, but it's just tradition because of Chitta. So, you know, he had 7 times and he made it in the end. So we decide to give other people 7 times, hoping at the 7th time they can make it as a monk. And if not, you know, get out of here. That's usually the tradition. You're allowed 7 times because of this story, Chitta. So 2 or 3 days later, Chitta, the son of the elephant trainer, went with Potapada, his friend, to see the Lord. Chitta prostrated himself before the Lord. He'd been a monk before, still a Buddhist. Sat down to one side. Potapada, still a wanderer, exchanged courtesies with the Lord, sat down to one side and told him what had happened. And Potapada, all those wanderers are blind and sightless. You alone among them are sighted. Flattery gets you everywhere. The Buddha was actually flattering this guy to, you know, bring him in, and you could see afterwards it worked. Some things I have taught and pointed out, Potapada, as being certain, others as being uncertain. Now, the word for certain here is a very interesting Pali word. It's like ekangsika. It's like one side. It's not certain. I think, what's it? There's only one side to it. It's only one point to it. It's not like a dual carriageway. It's just on the one side. It's very clear and precise. And the other side, uncertain, is nanatangsika, which is like many sides to it. In other words, it's just diverse. There's no real one answer. So what some things just have an answer, some things just have many answers. But he's translated there as certain, uncertain, which you can see where that comes from. But the full meaning of that Pali word is like, it's got one answer or many answers. Which other things have I pointed out as many answered? The world is eternal. The Tathagata exists after death. All of that sort of stuff. Why? Because they are not conducive to Nibbana. That is why I've declared them as uncertain. But what things have I pointed out as certain, like one answered, one leading to one thing? That this is suffering, this is the origin of suffering, this is the cessation of suffering, this is the path leading to the cessation of suffering, the Four Noble Truths. Why? Because they are conducive to the purpose, conducive to Dhamma, the way to embark on the holy life. They lead to disenchantment, to dispassion, to cessation, to calm, to higher knowledge, to enlightenment, to Nibbana, the highest happiness. That is why I have declared them. Potapada, there are some ascetics and Brahmins who declare and believe that after death, the self is entirely happy and free from suffering, free from disease, in the sense of dis-ease. I approached them and asked if this was indeed what they declared and believed, and they replied, yes. Then I said, do you friends living in this world know and see it as an entirely happy place? You know, this life. They replied, no. I said, have you ever experienced even a single night or day, or even half a night or day, that it was entirely happy? And they replied, no. And I say, do you know a path or practice whereby an entirely happy world might be brought about? And they replied, no. I said, have you heard the voices of deities who have been reborn in an entirely happy world, saying the attainment of an entirely happy world has been well and rightly gained, and we, gentlemen, have been reborn in such a realm? And they replied, no. Some people say that after you die, you go to heaven and you're entirely happy. This is what the Buddha is pointing to. He say, have you ever known any happiness in this world? Even for a day or for half a day? Has anyone told you a path we can be so happy?
Has any deities came down to you and said, yeah, there is this entirely happy heaven world. Will you be happy ever after? No. So what do you think, Potapada? Such being the case, does not the talk of those ascetics and Brahmin turn out to be stupid? And now this is one of the Buddha's famous similes. Another reason for actually bringing out this sutta. You've probably heard this simile before. This is where it comes from. It's just as if a man were to say, I am going to seek out and love the most beautiful girl in the country. They may say to him, well, as to this most beautiful girl in the country, do you know whether she belongs to the Kshatriya, the Brahmin, the merchant, or the artisan class? And he would say, no. Then they may say, well, do you know her name, her clan, whether she is tall or short, or of medium height, whether she is dark or light-complexioned or sallow-skinned, and what village or town or city she comes from? And he would say, no. And they might say, well then, you don't know or see the one you seek for and desire? And he would say, no. Does not the talk of that man turn out to be stupid?
Certainly, Lord.
So why do you seek for things you don't know if they even exist? And I've used that simile. Do you want to attain Nibbana? Do you know what Nibbana is? It's just like going around saying, I've fallen in love with this beautiful thing called Nibbana. That's where I'm going. I'm going to go and search for Nibbana. You don't even know what you're searching for. Do you? That's a great simile of the Buddha. And so it is with those ascetics and Brahmins who declare and believe that after death, the self is entirely happy and free from disease. Does all their talk turn out to be stupid? Certainly, Lord. It is just as if a man were to build a staircase for a mansion at a crossroads. People might say to him, well now, this staircase for this mansion that you are building, do you know whether the mansion will face east or west or north or south, or whether it will be high, low or medium height? He would say, no. And they might say, well then, you don't know or see what kind of mansion you are building the staircase for. And he would say, no. Don't you think that man's talk would turn out to be stupid? Certainly, Lord. So the Buddha is actually saying, very pragmatically, look, keep it simple, keep it to your understanding. And people actually say that after death is a happy place, but do you really know that? Can you know that? How do you know that? So keep it to your experience in this life until you know about a future life. See what happiness is. Don't build staircases to mansions which don't exist. Who was it? It was Led Zeppelin who wrote Staircase to Heaven. The problem was it didn't know where heaven was. It certainly wasn't in drugs, sex and rock and roll, that's for sure. Potapada. Verse 39. There are three kinds of acquired self. Now this is another sort of great part of this sutta, which reason I put it here. Acquired self. And this is actually just what you add on to the world. You sort of, it's like acquire a self. Not a real one, but an added on self. That's why I like to call it maybe, there are three kinds of added on self. Conjectured, acquired self. The gross acquired self, the mind-made acquired self, and the formless acquired self. What is this gross acquired self? It has form, is composed of the four great elements nourished by material food. What is the mind-made self? It has form, complete with all its parts, not defective in any sense organ. What is the formless acquired self? It is without form, made up just of perception. I'll just pause there, because those three selves also define the three worlds of Buddhism. We have this world of the form self, which comprises of the animals, even the ghosts in this realm, the hungry ghosts, even though you might say they're mind-made, but and the devas, they're fine material, they say. And then you've got the jhana realms. The jhana realms are manomaya. And the immaterial realms, the formless jhanas, they're pure perception. And there you can live in those realms of pure perception for eons after eons after eons. Just the first jhana realm is almost just on the edge between the Brahmaloka. It's almost on the edge between the form realm and the gross realm. Go from one to another, yes. Which is why that just when the end of the eon, when the form disappears, when the universe disappears, another material universe, beings can still go to those other realms, the Manomaya realm or the Sanyamaya realm, made of mind or made of perception. And it's independent of the form. So the cataclysms can happen. There are some deva realms which actually correspond to this realm. They're not that different. But there are the jhana realms which are made of mind, and the higher jhana realms made of perception. Fascinating, just the scope, because it's the mind which is the most important thing, and the mind creates those worlds. Yes. They've only got mind sense. They've only got the mind sense. They've got no other senses. They've got fine material form. They can't see. Maybe you can see them sitting absolutely still, eon after eon after eon. Anyway. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Yes. But I teach a doctrine, paragraph 40, for getting rid of the gross acquired self, whereby defiling mental states disappear and states tending to purification grow strong, and one gains and remains in the purity and perfection of wisdom here and now, having realized and attained it by one's own super knowledge. Now, Potapada, this is getting rid of the body and its five senses. And this is one of the important statements here. Now, Potapada, you might think, perhaps these defiling mental states might disappear, and one might still be unhappy. That is not how it should be regarded. If defiling states disappear, nothing but happiness and delight develops. Tranquility, mindfulness, and clear awareness, and that is a happy state. The reason I stress this is because this whole path is not just to make you more miserable. It's not to make you even like a vegetable, where you know you just sit here and know nothing moves you. This is not how it should be regarded. If defiling states disappears, nothing but happiness and delight develops. Happiness and delight, piti sukha, that's the only thing which develops, gets stronger and stronger and stronger. Nothing but happiness and delight develops, tranquility, mindfulness and clear awareness. And that's a happy state. I also teach the doctrine for getting rid of the mind-made acquired self. I also teach the doctrine for getting rid of the formless acquired self. And just taught that by the way of those jhanas. Potapadas, if others ask us, what friend is this gross acquired self whose abandonment you preach? Being so asked, we would require, this is that gross acquired self, for the getting rid of which we teach a doctrine. In other words, you see that through your own experience first. Understand what this gross acquired self is. Then you abandon it. Your body and the five senses. And you've seen the teaching of that. You get the jhanas. And then you abandon that gross self, the body, for a short while. You can't feel the body. The five senses disappear. You have got no backache, no leg ache. You can't feel your hands or anything. Your body's disappeared. The gross acquired self has gone. I also teach, what is this mind-made acquired self? You get into the jhanas. That is that self. And what is this formless acquired self? You attain your rupas. This is that self. In other words, you can point it out here and now in this very life. What do you think, Potapada? Does not that statement turn out to be well-founded? Certainly, Lord.
It is just as if a man were to build a staircase for a mansion or a palace which was below that mansion. The staircase was below it. You could actually see the palace. They might say to him, well now, this staircase for a palace you are building, do you know whether the palace will face east or west, north or south, whether it be high or low, medium height or whatever? He would say, this staircase is right under the palace. Don't you think that man's statement will be well founded? Certainly, Lord. In other words, you know what you're doing because it's your experience here and now. You know what that selves are through your experience, and then you abandon it. In just the same way, Potapada, if others ask us, what is this gross acquired self? What is this mind-made acquired self? What is this formless acquired self? We apply, this is this acquired self, either gross, mind-made, or formless, for the getting rid of which we teach a doctrine, whereby defiling mental states disappear and states tending to purification grow strong. And one gains and remains in the purity and perfection of wisdom, here and now in this very life, having realized and attained it by one's own super-knowledge. Don't you think this statement is well-founded? Certainly not. So you're not relying on some sort of revelation. You're not relying on some sort of idea. This is your own experience. At this, Chitta, the son of the elephant trainer, said to the Lord, Lord, whenever the gross acquired self is present, would it be wrong to assume the existence of the mind-made acquired self or the formless acquired self? Does only the gross acquired self truly exist then, and similarly with the mind-made acquired self and the formless acquired self? Chitta, whenever the gross acquired self is present, we do not at that time speak of a mind-made acquired self. We do not speak of a formless acquired self. We speak of only a gross acquired self. Similarly, whenever the mind-made acquired self is present, we speak only of that, not the other two. Chitta, suppose they were to ask you, did you exist in the past or didn't you? Will you exist in the future or won't you? Do you exist now or don't you? How would you answer? Lord, if I were asked such a question, I would say, I did exist in the past, I did not exist. I shall exist in the future, I shall not exist. I do exist now, I do not exist. That, Lord, would be my answer. But Chitta, if they ask, this past acquired self that you had, is that your only true acquired self, and are the future and present ones false? Or is the one you will have in the future the only true one, and are the past and present ones false? Or is your present one the only true one, and are the past and future ones false? How would you reply? Lord, if they asked me these things, I would reply, my past acquired self was at that time my only true one. The future and present ones at that time were false. My future acquired self will then be the only true one. The past and present ones will then be false. My present acquired self is now the only true one. The past and future ones are false. That is how I would reply. In just the same way, Chitta, whenever the gross acquired self is present, we do not at that time speak of the mind-made acquired self. And the same with the mind-made self or the formless self. In just the same way, Chitta, from the cow we get milk, from the milk curds, from the curds butter, from the butter ghee, and from the ghee cream of ghee. And when there is milk, we don't speak of curds or butter. We don't say the milk is curds. And when there is curds, we don't speak of butter, etc. When there's cream of ghee, we only speak of cream of ghee. This is the idea of like process. So there's all different types of self. No one of you is a true one, always persisting from time immemorial. Everything is always changing. That's why you call it acquired. Acquired for the time being. That's all. So, too, whenever the gross acquired self is present, we do not speak of the other ones. And going down paragraph 53 of the last sentence, but, Chitta, these are merely names, expressions, terms of speech, designations in common use in the world, which the Tathagata uses without misapprehending them. This is a common thing. We call it acquired self. We just use it for the time being. We don't think there's anything really there. This body, yeah, you can say this body. You know, you can say Ajahn Brahm. You can say Lawrence, you can say anybody. But you just use these as designations in common use in the world, which you can use without misapprehending them. And at these words, Potapada, the wanderer, said to the Lord, excellent Lord, excellent. It is as if somewhere to set up would have been knocked down, or to point out the way to one who got lost, or to bring an oil lamp into a dark place so that those with eyes could see what was there. Seems everybody says the same thing when they get inspired. It's very unlikely that he said that. He would have probably said it in his own particular way, but that's standard. It's just part of what happens when you keep the essence, of what actually happened, and the rest is more like fill packaging. But it's almost certain that the next bit was true in some way or other. Just so, the Blessed Lord has expanded the Dharma in various ways. Lord, I go for refuge to the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. Take this triple refuge. May the Lord accept me as a lay follower who has taken refuge in him from this day forth as long as life shall last. The taking of refuge. In other words, from now he wasn't a wanderer, he was a disciple of the Buddha. But Chitta, remember he'd been a monk 6 times already, and 6 times he disrobed. And he was the one who was answering all the deep questions. Potapada was just, he asked the first questions, but he just disappeared from the conversation afterwards. But Chitta, son of the elephant trainer, said to the Lord, "Excellent Lord, excellent. It is as if someone were to set up what had been knocked down, point out the way to one who got lost, to bring an oil lamp into a dark place so that those with eyes could see what was there. Just so the Blessed One has expanded the Dhamma in various ways. Lord, I go for refuge to the Buddha Dhamma and the Sangha. May I, Lord, receive the going forth of the Lord's hands. May I receive ordination." And Chitta, son of the elephant trainer, received the going forth of the Lord's hands and the ordination. And the newly ordained Venerable Chitta, alone, secluded, unwearying, zealous and resolute, in a short time, because he'd already done six times, in a short time attained to that for the sake of which young men of good birth, and even old men of good birth, and old women, young women of good or bad birth, go forth from their household life into homelessness, that unexcelled culmination of the holy life, having realized it here and now by his own super knowledge and dwelt therein, knowing birth is destroyed, the holy life has been lived, what had to be done has been done. There is nothing further here. And the Venerable Chitta, son of the elephant trainer, became yet another of the Arahats. So that is one of the most powerful suttas in the canon. That's why I read it out today. Not that long. Oh, I should have actually, that last page you see is on the first page, because when I photocopied these, I hope you could follow it, because the first page was blank, and to save paper, to be frugal, I put it on the first page. I think most of you figured that out. And that was the story of the Potapada Sutta, all about incredible teachings about non-self, anatta, about just how we have these different types of self which we can think about, we can almost like experience in the jhanas. There you have like a mind-made experience. But that's all there is. At that time, if you're in the jhanas, you have the manomaya acquired self. At that time, there's no body. There's none of the formless self. You just got that one. And same with the other experiences. So, you understand the different types of consciousness, each one a different species. So you can see there's nothing going from one moment to the next. Well, it's actually, they usually say that it goes to sort of manomayakaya as well, but mostly the manomayakaya actually is also the jhana realms of manomayakaya. But it's not like a growth. Well, even that, it's true, the manomayakaya are the ghosts as well. It's not. It's a gross realm, but it's not a gross. Even in, that's what, I think even in the hell realms, it's a manomayakaya, a mind-made body. Deva's a manomayakaya, mind-made bodies. That's why that you may have heard me say here about the hell realms. You make your body, and you make your punishments. They are manomaya. Even the suffering is made of your mind. What you think you deserve to experience. In the ultimate guilt trip. Literally. Yeah, that's great. Have you ever seen anyone who's paranoid here? In this realm? Human beings have got paranoia. They're in hell. Yes, pretty much so. Made of your mind.
That's why the mind is so important. If you get that right, then you're sweet. It's also the reason I like Potapada, because the great descriptions of the jhanas. And just how the Buddha, when he's asked that question about the extinction of consciousness, it's a great idea, the higher extreme extinction of consciousness. The very idea of that goes against most Western ideas of what Nibbana should truly be. Always think that there's sometime in Nibbana there's some ground of all consciousness or cosmic consciousness where you can be happy ever after. But there the Buddha was making it very clear. It's an extinction of consciousness, an extinction of perception. Are you ready yet to be extinguished? So there's lots of really deep stuff there. So it was a deep sutta, but I hope you enjoyed it. It gives you something to think about for the next 3 months until we come back again after the rage retreat for the next sutta class. Ah. Sorry? Yeah, okay, go on. It's if at the time of your death you even ask that question, you're missing the point. The best place to practice is now. So when you die, don't even look for another world. Now, and let go. Is that interesting? It's according to the tradition, many people, they stuff up when they're alive. So they try, can't get it together, they can't really understand. But the time of their death is a powerful experience. And that's the time when many people gain attainments. So if you don't get it, you know, while you're alive, the time when you're dead, you're just dead. That's a great time, or just beforehand, a few minutes or seconds before you die. It's a great time to become enlightened. So at that time, don't look for any other place except now. To let go. The Dharma is teaching you, when your death, that all things pass away. Nothing is mine. So the best place to die, or the best place to go, is the place where you've got the most letting go. So that would be the jhana realms, or the arupa realms, or even better, the anagami realms. And don't think, if I get reborn in the jhana realms, I just got to wait there for such a long time. And then what happens afterwards from the jhana realms, I might fall back into a hell realm. It's incredibly unlikely. If you just come out of a jhana realm for eons, your mind is just so pure. The energy which results from that, you'd probably be reborn in a, if it's a heavenly realm or a deva realm, or a human realm, very, very close to the Dhamma. Because for eons, your mind has been inclining to letting go. So when you come back again, that inclination will be incredibly strong. Yeah? No, you are meditating in the jhana realms. In the heavenly realms you can, but in a sense you disappear if you start meditating in there. It's not quite true, because Brahma, in his realm, whenever he meditates, just goes into the first jhana and out again. You can do it in there. The lower jhana realms, sometimes you can, sometimes you can't. Yes. Absolutely, yeah. Same as many other beings. And now it is possible to attain in the heavenly realms. There's many stories. You can read these books here. You see that in the many devas were listening to the talk, and many devas became sort of once returners or arahats as they listened. And the Buddha went out to teach the devas sometimes. So, yeah, it's some devas can, you know, practice, and they can develop. But they're the minority, simply because they're just having a bit too much of a good time. But if you've been a Buddhist and get reborn in the deva realm, you know, just because of your practice, as opposed to being reborn in the deva realm because you've just been a really kind, good, generous person, then the chances are you'll carry on practicing there. Make Make sense? Okay, so there we go. We went on a little bit today because it was a long session. The last session, a big sutta. Please take those pieces of paper away with you. You can keep them and keep looking at them from time to time. A great sutta. Okay, now pay respects to Buddha Dhamma Sangha.
Arahaṃ sammā sambuddho bhagavā buddhaṃ bhagavantaṃ abhivādhemi suvākkhato bhagavata dhammo dhammaṃ namassāmi Supatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho sanghaṃ namāmi.